Most of these incidents are things that went too far. Disputes over different things, over drugs or things like that.
Anchorage closes 2016 with a record number of homicides. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the potential for heavy snowfall in South Central and Interior.
Trying to knock snow off of some of the lines and stuff like that to try to help alleviate some of the outages.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
It's been a deadly year in Anchorage. As of today, there have been 34 homicides, more than in any previous year on record. 2015 also saw an exceptionally high number of violent deaths, but as Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, with no one factor responsible for the surge in homicides, there's no clear solution to the problem.
Throughout this year, news reports in Alaska's largest city have been particularly morbid, with frequent stories about shootings and homicides.
Overnight, police found their bodies in a popular downtown park.
In July alone, there were 9 homicides within the municipality.
Police caught up with a third suspect today in connection with a double murder on Christmas Eve.
Police and elected officials have been active for months, trying to get out a message to the public that even amid the grim headlines, Anchorage remains a relatively safe place. During an interview in August, Police Chief Chris Tolley explained that the most consistent factor in homicides was the presence of drugs and alcohol.
Most of these incidents are things that went too far. Disputes over different things, over drugs or things like that. It's incidents that have gone too far.
Tolley, as well as spokespeople for the Anchorage Police Department, have stressed that there is no one cause behind the last 2 years of high homicide numbers. Deaths from intimate partner violence are above average this year. The number of young people under the age of 21 involved in shootings is dramatically up, which is alarming to police. And 5 deaths have been connected to the same gun used by James Dale Ritchie, suggesting a pattern of targeted killings. Ritchie himself died in a shootout with an APD officer, one of 4 men killed by police in Anchorage since the start of the year, figures that are not included in how the city reports homicide statistics. Looming over conversations about violence is the question of whether Anchorage has a gang problem. In an email, an APD spokesperson wrote that investigators have not found a link between gang activity and the high number of homicides this year. Chief Tolley, speaking on Talk of Alaska this past fall, described a gang presence in Anchorage, but stopped short of connecting it to the high number of homicides.
We have seen some activity where there are gang links, for lack of better words, that people have some type of association to gang, but not the same sort of territorial and full-blown gang activity that these other cities experience. Mm-hmm. Most of it's just through affiliation.
This characterization can seem like semantics, particularly when other law enforcement agencies are publicly pointing to gangs as the source of increased violence and crime. On Wednesday, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Anchorage announced the final sentence coming down in an investigation that led to convictions against 12 individuals for crimes stemming from gang activity. According to federal officials, the Fairview mob was linked to a chapter of the Bloods in California, and sentences were handed down for crimes involving drug trafficking, money laundering, and firearms possession. Though no one from the FBI's violent crime squad in Anchorage was available to comment, during a recent interview with KTVA News, Special Agent Mike Watson described how the lucrative drug market in Anchorage and across Alaska fuels gang activity.
People can, from the lower 48 or, you know, other areas, can come up here and make a lot of money selling narcotics. With that, we'll get, you know, people up here part-time from some of the lower 48 gangs.
But researchers caution against scapegoating any one particular cause to try and explain this year's homicides.
Just knowing the number of crimes that occur really doesn't help you to figure out what the problem is.
Troy Payne is an associate professor of justice at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He says in the last three decades, Anchorage's homicide rate has averaged 7.4 deaths per 100,000 people. This year, it's 11.4. That's still a fraction of what larger, more violent American cities face, but it does represent a tripling from the rate in Anchorage during 2014. Professor Payne shares APD's view that this increase is likely from a perfect storm of several different factors all converging. He adds, though, that without more thorough information about the individual cases, it's mere speculation to say whether the last 2 years are outliers or an emerging trend.
We don't know if that is just random fluctuation of the number of homicides and the homicide rate, or whether there is a systemic, repeatable problem that we could apply solutions to. We simply just don't know that.
Payne adds that police only have so much control over violent crime, and the homicide rate should not be the lone metric used for assessing a police department. The clearance rate for homicide cases, for example, is 90% this year, up dramatically from where it was decades ago. That's a view shared not only by APD, but also the mayor's administration and community advocates, who have pointed to reduced police staffing in previous years, as well as cuts to social services and community programming, as factors contributing to an overall increase in crime within the municipality over the last year. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
South Central Alaska, including Anchorage, is bracing for a predicted snowfall that could be significant. The National Weather Service says up to 8 inches of snow is predicted for Anchorage starting today and continuing into Friday. North of the state's largest city, the Weather Service says the largest snowfall in several years is possible for portions of the Matanuska Valley. Highest levels are expected along the mountains. South of Anchorage on the Kenai Peninsula, snow is expected to mix with rain or change completely to rain. The Weather Service says that with existing snow cover and anticipated colder temperatures tonight, that could lead to icing concerns and hazardous driving conditions. The city of Fairbanks is also gearing up for a snowstorm that's expected to bring as much as a foot of snow and strong winds to the interior. With heavy snow and wind in the forecast, Golden Valley Electric Association in Fairbanks is bracing for power outages. GVEA Vice President for Member Services Brian Youngberg says there were already small outages yesterday due to snow and trees weighing on power lines, and crews have been in the field working to minimize problems.
Trying to knock snow off of some of the lines and stuff like that to try to help alleviate some of the outages.
Youngberg cautions members to stay away from trees on power lines and to contact Golden Valley, which will dispatch a crew. The utility is urging members to update their phone number on the utility's website in advance of the storm. Youngberg says that will enable a new phone system designed to speed outage response.
The system will automatically recognize as they're calling in, and it'll streamline their reporting process and help us in getting their outage logged into our system so we can respond quicker.
Youngberg says the phone system was installed this summer as the result of recent years' outages. Those include major winter storm incidents that affected thousands of members. In Southeast, an avalanche on Mount Juno yesterday at around 1 p.m. fortunately did not harm people or property. The path of the avalanche went toward the uninhabited Silver Bow Basin. Juno's Emergency Programs Director Tom Matisse says there have been no reports of missing people, injuries, or property damage.
Yeah, we saw an impressive powder cloud, but no, that was not a catastrophic-sized avalanche.
With a relatively low snowpack, Matisse says he was a little surprised by the natural avalanche.
The Earth's terrain acts like an egg carton, and so we might lose one egg here or one egg there, but we don't lose the whole carton very often. But after the snow builds up throughout the season and that egg carton gets completely loaded up, then we get a lot bigger avalanches.
Matisse says the urban avalanche risk remains moderate today. He encourages residents and people enjoying the outdoors and avalanche-prone areas to use common sense and to keep an eye on the urban avalanche advisories he regularly updates online at juno.org/avalanche. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, cleaning up a spill near Cook Inlet.
They've discovered two holes in the line, but we don't know if there's any others.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. And by GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
State wildfire officials report a rare winter incident in Delta Junction. An Alaska Division of Forestry post says a 20 by 50 foot fire was called in by passersby December 20th, who spotted the burn on trails behind the Delta High School. Delta Area State Fire Management Officer Mike Goyette says 20 to 30 trees burned, noting that the fire also burned down to mineral soil, evidence of this season's very dry conditions. Goyette suspects the fire resulted from an abandoned campfire and cautions that even with snow on the ground, people need to treat campfires the same as they do during the summer and completely extinguish them before leaving. He says in the winter, that means stirring snow through coals until they are cold. Seismic unrest continues at Bogoslav Volcano. Scientists are watching the eruption around the clock, even though monitoring stations are far from the site. Chris Way Thomas with the U.S. Geological Survey is observing a particular indication of increased seismic activity, volcanic tremors.
And you can think of it as the sort of signal that you might get if you were to seismically monitor an organ pipe. As air moves through the pipe, it resonates. And when it impinges on the pipe, it produces motion, and that's what we're kind of measuring.
The problem, Way Thomas says, is there's a lot of wind, and that can obscure the signal.
It looked to us like there was an increase in this tremor signal, and we wanted to alert everybody that it's possible that this could be accompanied by a large steam or ash emission.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory also has access to satellites, which they use to look for steam or ash plumes and thermal signals, but cloud cover is making it difficult to confirm. Bogoslav Volcano began erupting last week. A remote Alaska village is renewing efforts to build a road through a national wildlife refuge so residents with medical problems will have land access to an all-weather airport. The village of King Cove, with the backing of Alaska's congressional delegation, wants a road through Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge, an internationally recognized haven for migratory waterfowl. The village of 900 is near the tip of the Alaska Peninsula. Foul weather and mountains make flights notoriously unreliable. A road would connect King Cove to an all-weather airport at Cold Bay. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell rejected a road 3 years ago, concluding that the refuge would be harmed. King Cove leaders and U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says they will push for the road when President-elect Donald Trump takes office. Incidences of gun violence at schools in the U.S. are increasingly dominating the national spotlight, raising questions about school security and what can be done to ensure the safety of students. As APRN's Josh Edge reports, Anchorage schools are taking a proactive approach.
Tom Roth is the chief operating officer of the Anchorage School District. His position supervises everything from buses to student lunches to safety. He says the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in December 2012 was a watershed event for education.
That event really generated a significant effort to improve the physical security in all the schools.
The shooting left more than 25 people dead at a Newtown, Connecticut elementary school. Improving the physical security of schools requires renovations, especially among older buildings, which Roth says were not necessarily designed with security top of mind.
In older schools, you'll see the offices remote from the front entrance, whereas if you were to go into a newer school, say Clark Middle School here in Anchorage, Clark Middle School, probably one of the newest schools that we've got, The offices are at the front entrance. The principals are able to observe anybody walking up to and into the school, as are the administrators.
In addition to moving the main offices, the district is also adding remote locking capabilities to the doors and installing new security camera systems. The Sandy Hook shootings did not only change the district's thoughts on the physical aspects of security, but on the mental and emotional aspects as well. So, at the beginning of this school year, the Anchorage School District implemented a new response strategy known as ALICE. It stands for Alert, Lockdown, Inform, Confront, and Evacuate.
Say if I'm in one end of the school and I discover as a teacher that there is an intruder on the far end of the school that I'm significantly away from, then one of the things I can do, I can evacuate potentially the building with my students to get them away from the risk.
That's a change from the old strategy of just staying put and locking classrooms down. And Roth says the new system has received a lot of positive feedback from teachers.
I think that they feel more secure because they feel more trained and ready to react in an appropriate way.
As of mid-November, Roth says all of the district's school staff finished ALICE training. And now schools will hold regularly scheduled ALICE drills, where students will react to instructions from teachers that could range from locking down a classroom to evacuating out a side door. Roth believes the combination of physical and mental preparation serves as a deterrent. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Workers at a Tesoro facility on the Kenai Peninsula are cleaning up contaminated soil and snow after more than 120 gallons of oily water spilled out of a pipeline near Cook Inlet. The company notified the state of the spill at its Kenai Pipeline facility on December 18th. Jade Gamble, who works in spill response with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, has been doing site visits ever since.
Yeah, it was the spill was contained very quickly. They were on site when it happened, and they were able to deploy some absorbent boom around the spill so that it did not spread any further.
She says the cleanup has been slow. They're using hand axes and jackhammers to chip away at the frozen soil. The company will process the contaminated snow and water on site while the soil will be burned. Workers also drained and shut down the pipe. Gamble says it isn't yet clear exactly how the spill happened.
They've discovered two holes in the line, but we don't know if there's any others, like I say, because it was, some of it is subsurface.
The company is cleaning up what has been contaminated and exploring the buried parts of the line to make sure there are no other leaks. In an emailed statement, Tesoro says there have been no injuries or impacts on local wildlife. Gamble says the spill hasn't reached Cook Inlet. According to DEC data, there have been at least five spills over 50 gallons at that facility in the last 17 years. Demolition has begun on a shuttered interior Alaska refinery that once produced jet fuel, heating oil, gasoline, and asphalt from North Slope oil carried in the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Flint Hills Resources' Jeff Cook says the company has begun tearing down its North Pole plant. Jeff Cook says no one was interested in buying and operating the refinery, and the company decided the prudent step was to demolish it. The refinery opened in 1977. It stopped refining operations in 2014. North Pole Mayor Bryce Ward says demolition is sad, but kind of inevitable. He says the demolition will have financial consequences for the city because the tax value of the property will be further reduced. Fuel storage operations at the site will continue. Once President Barack Obama signs the National Defense Authorization Act into law, the city of Galena will acquire a hefty plot of public land. 1,290 acres, where the Campion Air Force radar station used to be located, will be conveyed to Galena for the purpose of preventing future flood damage to the city. Congressman Don Young added the provision for the Galena land transfer to this year's version of the National Defense Authorization Act, which has already passed through the House and the Senate. Matt Shukaro, the congressman's communications director, says Congressman Young has put in years of work to achieve this goal.
In the previous NDAA, he was able to secure this amendment in the House version, but unfortunately, through final negotiations, a number of land transfer provisions were ultimately excluded. So that's the challenge we faced last year. He came back to the table with it again this year, and we were able to secure that. So we're very proud of that, and in addition to a number of other land transfers included in the bill.
Shukaro says the city of Galena could use this land for further protection from natural disasters such as flooding.
As others recall, in 2013, there was massive flooding from the Yukon River, and they have had threats in the past and will continue to have them in the future. And that's in part because of the low level of land or area in which the city is built. By securing that transfer, it gives Galena the options to potentially move that town to ensure the safety from future floods.
It's unclear what the city of Galena will do with this land, but Shukaro claims the land is no longer in use and the community requested the transfer. Ultimately, the Secretary of the Interior will have to convey the land, and that could fall to Ryan Zinke, President-elect Trump's pick for the position. Shukaro says regardless of who the Secretary of Interior is, the bill will be enacted.
The congressman spoke extensively with the incoming nominee, Representative Ryan Zinke. They had a great conversation and talked about some of their different issues that we face. And while they may have some differences on some issues, the congressman ultimately felt positive at their conversation in terms of management and understanding that we need to break down some of the needless bureaucracy and we need to make sure that we can streamline development.
The National Defense Authorization Act can also become law if President Obama puts his signature on it or if he takes no action within a certain amount of time. Shukaro expects the bill will be passed before Obama's term ends. A decline in the numbers of mature razor clams in the past several years has prompted the state Fish and Game Department to curtail clamming on East Cook Inlet beaches for the foreseeable future. In an emergency order released yesterday, state biologists closed beaches from the tip of the Homer Spit to the mouth of the Kenai River to razor clam harvests through the entire year of 2017. Both sport and personal use clamming are affected by the order. A continued low abundance of mature razor clams in the area has worried biologists. According to Fish and Game, the closure prohibits the taking of any clam species from East Cook Inlet beaches from January 1st through December 31st of next year. Surveys show mature razor clam abundance at historic low levels at Ninilchik and Clam Gulch, although juvenile clams seem to be above average numbers. Biologists say the numbers may be on the rebound, and a survey planned for next year will determine if that is the case. The decline in mature razor clam numbers is not known at this time, although biologists say it could be due to natural mortality or to a poor settlement of clam eggs. Overharvesting has been ruled out as a cause. The razor clam harvest closure does not affect beaches on the west side of Cook Inlet. Coming into the region at the start of the new year is a NEST project focused on Inupiaq language revitalization in the area of Nome. KNOM's Davis Hovey reports a Nome-based nonprofit organization called Inusik Incorporated, which started up this year, is spearheading the project.
So Inusik Inc. was created by four young Inuit women, myself, Evelik, Patty Keller, I'm the chair, Kunuk, Marjorie Tabone is the vice chair, Utamana, Rachel Bauman is the board treasurer, and Kiminok, Maddie Alvana Stimple is the board secretary. We started this nonprofit because we felt like we're lost. There's a piece of us that is missing. We felt disconnected as Native people from our culture.
That's Inusik's board chair, Evelik, also known as Hattie Keller. She explains the meaning of the word Inusik for those who don't speak Inupiaq.
Inusik, it means life or our way of life in Inupiaq. And Its sole purpose is to reclaim what we feel is lost, and that's our language, our culture, our values, our practices.
Keller and many Native Alaskans' sense of loss of culture or language started generations ago. According to Keller, it had a lot to do with the trauma Native people experienced while in school.
I visited Shishmaref in April. I spoke to an elder and I asked her, how did you go to school and how was it? And she told me when she went to school, they only were able to speak English. They were hit on the hand or put outside and made to stand outside all day if they spoke any Inupiaq. So this is 2 to 3 generations before me, and I would speak to other elders in our community, and they said, I went through that too.
Keller says it takes about 3 generations of people to integrate a spoken language into a family. So that's how many generations this language nest will use at one time.
In 2017, it'll be tangible. We'll have a Inupiaq linguist and a teacher or a child care provider that will help the linguist. And in turn, the child care provider / teacher will learn from the linguist while teaching our children, because most likely our Inupiaq linguist will be an elder. So that's 3 generations, the linguist, and then the next generation is a teacher, and then the new generation is our children, 0 to 3.
Keller says for now, this language nest will be based in Shishmaref and will focus on children that are up to 3 years old, kind of like a daycare facility, but with some differences.
What makes it a language nest instead of just a daycare is that it's going to provide the parents and the grandparents with learning these materials. Right now, we are renting a building from the city of Shishmaref. It's the old Northwest Campus building in Shishmaref. And in future locations, we'd like to go throughout the region. Progressively, we'll move to the children as they grow older in different grades. Hopefully, we'll go to preschool next, and then after preschool, Head Start.
Ultimately, Keller's vision for Inusik's role in language and cultural revitalization in the region is much bigger.
So my overall goal in, let's say, the next 50 years, that we speak 4 languages. We speak English, we speak Inupiaq, we speak St. Lawrence Island Yupik, and Yupik.
Inusik has already started hiring employees for 2017, including teachers and linguists, to begin working at the new language nest located in Shishmaref. Reporting in Nome, I'm Davis Hovey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Josh Edge, and Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jeremy Shea and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Davis Hovey in Nome. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.